Hi, I'm Paul Cheel, and you're listening to the public relations podcast, Smoke Signal. In this episode, we are tackling the climate crisis. We are 6 months on from COP26, where it's fair to say the outcome didn't match the hype. Australia's State of the Environment report has just been released and generated worldwide headlines for the grim picture it painted of the environmental challenges facing Australia. And we are seeing an energy crisis globally as we struggle to agree how to transition to renewables. Against this backdrop, we take a timely and much needed deep dive into the role of the PR industry in helping to inform, educate, and navigate this global climate crisis. Joining me on this episode is UK-based practitioner Laura Sutherland, founder of Aura Advisory, a strategic communication and advisory consultancy dedicated to helping organisations accelerate to a sustainable future. Laura is also a member of the PRCA Misinformation and Climate Crisis Strategy Group and recently led on an annual research report exploring the attitudes and perceptions of PR practitioners as well as consumers towards the climate crisis. Laura, thank you for joining me on this episode of the Smoke Signal podcast.
Good morning and thank you for having me.
Let's start with some of the key findings that came out of this research, which I'll provide a link to on the blog. I think the most stark or perhaps surprising is just how involved PR professionals now are in helping organisations navigate their sustainable responsibilities, with 9 out of 10 PR professionals saying they advise clients on the climate crisis. Was this a surprising result for you?
Yeah, this was the second piece of research that we conducted, and it was actually up from 82% last year. So that's quite a hike, you know, in the space of just over a year. But it's also symbolic, I think, of the fact that we are now moving to much more of a strategic advisor's role within organisations than just a delivery function. We're actually now part of the management team, part of the leadership team, and helping make decisions and helping inform those decisions as well. So I think that the change in those that are advising is potentially because of that.
What do you think is driving that change and that push into that C-suite and being able to have these discussions? I mean, it does feel like 2022 has been a really defining year for PR. To use its power for good and address the climate crisis. I guess, you know, it probably can be traced back to the start of the year when Edelman was called out and petitioned to drop its clients who were in the climate space or fossil fuel production space. Do you think we're heading to an area where it's like big tobacco and big oil where that's going to be increasingly the case? And why do you think that is, that the PR is having such an impact?
I think we have a massive opportunity. I think we've got a huge opportunity to start using our roles in the strategic function for good, as you say. And the reason that I do think that is because we have pushed, and I know personally I've pushed for years, for us to become more recognised as a valuable function, a strategic function, and to have that place at the C-suite table. And with that push, it has meant that we have had to turn up the volume in terms of our education and how we're educating ourselves. So continuous professional development, for example, the areas that we're learning in, that are not just related to traditional public relations. So we're now learning much more about psychology, behavioural science, human resources, finance, climate change now. And we are now, we have to be able to do that in order to be able to advise. So I think we have this opportunity now that we are pushing ourselves forward. We are able to advise because we now are informed ourselves. And I think that is half the battle, that we have to be able to inform ourselves before we can start advising other people. And we set out in the group to first and foremost educate our industry, because if we don't start within, how are we going to then work out with, which then comes to, you know, the consumer or to our clients or in our organizations. So we've made that push, and I think, you know, there are definitely still places for non-strategic advisors, because, you know, there are the people that are going to be delivering. But for the senior leaders in our industry, it is so important that we educate ourselves and that we understand the impact and the scenarios and the risks associated. And when we talk about risks, you know, that's not really something we were talking about in public relations 10, 15 years ago. Now we much more talk about, you know, risk management, risk assessments, the risk register. And these are the part of the strategic functions of an organization. And it's so important that we're across all of that, so we're fully aware. So it kind of comes part and parcel with a step up to the bigger role and the strategic role.
So how do practitioners go about that? You know, if it was issues management, you know, there's a book on that. If it's media relations, there's a book on that. If it's communication planning, there's a book on that. But I wouldn't say there's a book on this yet, right, about how do you actually do it? What are best practice principles? So how do practitioners listening, you know, go on that journey to do that education as you described?
Yeah, I think that's a really great question, because part of this research, my own research with clients, is that people don't know where to start. There's so much jargon, there are so many initiatives, there is so much out there that people just don't know where to start. And I think the point we're trying to make is you have to start somewhere. So we have partnered, the PRC has partnered with the Royal Meteorological Society and has developed a half-day training course on the climate change situation, about data and about where to find the right information. And it's a really great course because it's a great sort of learning point of what climate change is and how it came about and what's happening. And I think that's one of the first ports of call, that if you're going to start advising in something, start to understand the subject. So definitely would recommend that. Also, the group that I'm involved with the PRCA, we have had held a number of free events and webinars, which are freely available to look at on YouTube. And we've had lots of guests on, from brands to climate experts to journalists in the climate field and environment field. And we have had, you know, long, full discussions, some tough discussions as well, about some of the questions that we need answered. And those sorts of things will really help inform your thinking. It will help you to ask more questions, which I think is really important. You continue to ask questions. And hopefully we'll be able to give you a really good basis for starting to think about how you want to tackle this with your organisation or your clients. Because actually, at the moment, there is no right or wrong way to do it, because we're all at the start of this. And in terms of best practice, there isn't a playbook on it. We're starting at the beginning to try different things and to help each other. And if there's anything that I've learned in my journey through working in sustainability, environment and climate in the last 10 years of my career, has been that collaboration is really, really important. Collaboration across public sector, private sector, third sector and society. And also that if you do have learnings, if you've done something the right way, or even if you've done something the wrong way, then share that widely, because that is going to help other people learn. And it will help you learn and move on and not make that mistake again, or it will help your learnings and your thinking around how you want to progress.
So could you put that into, I guess, perspective and practice for us? And one of the reasons I was keen to talk to you was, I mean, from a client perspective with the clients you work with, what are the challenges that you're helping them solve? And I guess, how do some of the findings that you've seen in the research reflect what you're seeing in practice?
So I suppose to kind of set the scene, I first started working in sort of climate change, sustainability, as I said, maybe about 10 years ago. I handled the communication for Scotland's 2020 climate group. And we were well known globally for Scotland actually setting really, really very difficult targets, but actually beating them by 2020. And that came around through the group working across private sector, public sector, third sector, and society, being really supported by government to be able to do that. And that is key. The government really needs to buy into it and needs to commit to it. When you set targets, obviously setting targets means that you have to do something to achieve them. You have to take action. And I think that is part of where organizations and businesses are struggling to understand how to set those targets in perspective for their business and for themselves. And so with those targets, you know, you look at the UN Sustainable Development Goals. One thing that I do as part of my role as a consultant and advisor is I have a framework that I work to that I've called the Synergy Framework. And basically it is a combination, an integration of stakeholder relations and all the things that come with that. So mapping, auditing, scoring, channel matrix, etc. Then you've got the UN Sustainable Development Goals, which are 17, but within those 17, there are over 160 actions within that. And then you have your strategic communication around that. So that's strategy development, bringing all that together. And then there's reporting, measurement and evaluation. So those four different elements are what makes up a framework that I've developed, which guides the client along the way on that journey to understanding who their stakeholders are and want and need. Because at the end of the day, we're being driven by stakeholder demand at the moment, which is a good thing because it's forcing businesses and it's forcing brands to listen and to take action. But the next part is where they don't actually know where to start. And that's where the UN Sustainable Development Goals really come in. Kind of handy, I suppose. They're there. They don't need to be remodeled. They don't need to be regurgitated in a different way. They are there. They're in existence for a reason, and they are global. So if you look at those 17 goals, I wouldn't say that every 17 goals is going to be relevant to every brand and organization. However, if you go through those 17 goals, you'll quickly identify what is relevant to your organization. And you'll then be able to prioritize what you're able to do. And realistically, that has to, you know, you have to consider things like your resources in terms of finance and also your manpower to be able to deliver it and in the time scale that it's going to be delivered as well. These are, you know, kind of processes that we would commonly use within public relations anyway. But what
it sounds quite rigorous though, right? It's certainly not a soft approach. It's a very rigorous approach by what you've just described there.
Yeah, and I think that's where I mean I personally have I've never really been a traditional public relations specialist, and that's where my advisory stuff comes from, because it's more than just communicating. I'm actually solving problems and I'm helping clients solve their problems. If I, you know, my tagline is accelerate to a sustainable future, then if you look at that word sustainable and sustainability, it's not just about climate. It's actually much more than that. It's a much bigger conversation around what makes a sustainable business. But if you look at the UN Sustainable Development Goals, you will see that every area you could think of is covered in there. Everything from diversity and inclusion to well-being to the living wage to all these different things which make up a sustainable future for a business, but also for people as well. And that's why, you know, people often refer to people and planet, because you are looking at both as one thing essentially, because you're integrating both of them within this sort of strategy and plan. And it has to be robust. Because if you're not making it robust, then you're not like really committing to it and you're not really being informed at your approach. And so the reason that we're doing the research within the Misinformation and Climate Strategy Group is because we couldn't set off on a path of let's go and talk about misinformation and the climate crisis in relation to our industry if we didn't know what our industry were doing, if we didn't know what they thought about it. And in perspective, what the consumer thought about it and, you know, did they know what to look for, or did they trust specific sources? And by asking those questions and really doing some research on it, we can really have a proper picture of what, you know, society, what consumers are thinking, the public, and also then what our industry is thinking. And since last year, what has been really welcomed has been the increase in our public relations and communication professionals noticing that their clients or organisations have been attempting to greenwash. And actually within that 45%, 89% have pushed back on it, and 57% have managed to then change the approach as a result. So I think that's brilliant, because we're now looking at actually the impact of the work we're doing and being able to stand up to potentially leaders who are wanting to take a certain route. And we're actually saying, do you know what? That is not the best route to take, because that's greenwashing, or you can't say that because you don't have the data, or you can't say that because it's conflicting. So I think we've started on this journey in the industry now, and we're really and this is why these opportunities to talk on people's podcasts and blog for people and things are brilliant, because we can really then start to spread the word much more widely and start that conversation as an industry, so that we're working together and that we're sharing, we're learning, and we're collaborating.
I think a critical comment you made within that was this idea of, it's not just about communicating it, we're advising, right? So we're helping set the direction and, as you say, push back against things like greenwashing, making sure we're doing this in the right way, making sure we're aligning to the developmental goals. Mm. It's much more than just communicating.
And I think that is where our industry has, again, changed. The perception of public relations is writing press releases. So it may as well be called press release rather than public relations. The perception of communication is that it's writing words and it's saying something. But what people forget, and what we're trying to reinforce as the strategic management function, is that we have to have everything in mind before we make those words. We have to think about how it's going to land, how it's going to make people feel. Is it inclusive, or are there barriers to understanding it? From a behavioral science perspective, do we have to test do we have to test those messages on different groups before we go out there? Do we then get the feedback, and do we then tweak it as necessary? And then what's the result of that? You know, one of the challenges, and I'm sure this is not an uncommon subject to discuss, but one of the biggest challenges we have in the industry is measurement and evaluation of our work. And that's because inherently people just went out there and they did tactical things. They didn't set smart objectives. They didn't set it against the business objectives. There were never really any sort of strategies put in place. It was quite tactical. Whereas now, we're, you know, you were talking about what I was saying was, you know, a really robust approach. And that robust approach is absolutely essential in anything we do, if we're to predict what we want as an outcome, and as if we're going to have that positive impact. Because you can't measure something that you haven't really started out being very specific about what you're going to achieve and how you're going to do that. Just going out there with tactics is not going to demonstrate that you have done very much. So people in the industry, leaders in the industry, know how important it is to have that approach. And as I said before, don't get me wrong, there's a role for everybody. Not everyone has to be strategic. Not everyone has to be advising. Everyone has to start somewhere as well. But if we're to progress in the industry and we're to be that strategic advisor in that role, whether it's sustainability, the climate crisis, or whatever, our job is much more important than just the words of something. Whether it's a press release or a statement or a blog, a piece of thought leadership, it might be an annual report, it might be standing up and giving a speech in front of people. How's that going to land? How's that going to make people feel? And what action will people take as a result of hearing, seeing what you've done? And also, much, much more importantly, Are you backing that up with action? And that's where this climate crisis conversation starts. Are you taking action?
Yes, regular listeners of the podcast will know that measurement is a passion of mine, so I won't get into that because it's a whole nother discussion, right? it couldn't be a more critical space to be measuring in, right, and be showing impact than the climate crisis. So it is certainly very relevant, more so than in this space than any other. Back to the research, what else did you hear from practitioners or from – you also kind of went out to a broader public group. What were the other key findings that you found in the research?
I think, well, we have to kind of maybe put things in perspective that we don't – we didn't go out there with asking all the questions of what level are you working at and how much your salary and, in terms of demographics. We have to assume that the people that responded to this were of a fairly senior level because they wouldn't be advising on climate crisis otherwise. And it would definitely put juniors off because they wouldn't know where to start. But other things that came out in the consumer report, actually, 50% believe, or 50% don't believe as well, that the planet faces existential threat due to the man-made climate crisis. So 50-50. People believe it, and 50 people don't believe it.
Yeah.
That's crazy.
Do you think that's a function of misinformation that's out there?
Yeah, so what we're starting to share in amongst our industry are really interesting stories which have been circulated to help our understanding of why things have maybe started on the wrong path. One thing that I was saying recently was in the United States. Now, I will not quote the exact thing because I will quote it wrong and I don't want to be spreading misinformation. But the general story went along the lines of when years ago when there was an election taking place, when there was votes taking place, the political party in question, which I won't name, basically set on a path of misinformation so that they protected the industries like the tobacco industry because they believed that it was going to be more harmful on the economy if they were to start, setting goals and telling them to change their ways. And so we're still seeing effects of that just now because that's sometimes when people read things like that online, when they go into the archives, when they start thinking about what's happened in political land, or when they even start talking to people that have been part of that sort of legacy, I suppose, that's been passed down through those conversations, that's when people start to doubt things. But also there are specific people that have been, if you look at the war at the moment in Ukraine and the misinformation that has been coming out from that and on purpose, obviously, to try and change the narrative to, to woe is me for Russia. And these things are all contributing to people questioning data and people questioning science. But if you look at the data and you look at science and the climate crisis, you will see what the absolutely stark figures are. And if you even look at the UK, the heat wave that we had last week, the UK reached 40 degrees last week. And scientists were hugely alarmed by this because they knew we reached 40 degrees at some point in time. But they never dreamt it would be as quickly as last week. And so data is there, science is there, it's all backed up. And I suppose what I would really say is that if you're going to be talking about anything, if you're going to be advising clients on anything, make sure that you're 100% sure on the accuracy of the information that you're going to be either sharing with your client or that your client wants to share. Because you have to be 100% sure. It's like crisis communication. We don't go out there without actually backing up the facts that we know and we checked out ourselves. We have to be fully 100% sure that what we're saying is correct.
But you also found, or the research also showed, over 2/3 of consumers said they would stop buying from a brand if they knew it had misled customers on their environmental impact. So there's clearly a bottom line rationale for organizations to be involved in this discussion and for PR professionals to be having that discussion with the C-suite.
Yeah, and I think that's where that whole stakeholder relations piece comes from that I was talking about, where, you know, stakeholders are driving that conversation forward. And by stakeholders, just for clarification, I mean everybody that's internal and external that has anything to do with your organization or your brand. And that's why that stakeholder relations piece before you start writing strategy is so important, because you need to research your stakeholders and what they need and what they want. And that will help to drive your strategy in the right direction, and it'll help your business to be more sustainable as a result. And I think that that figure, 7 in 10 say they'd likely stop buying from a brand if they knew it misled them. I think that's because consumers are now being much more wise to the fact that brands are misleading on purpose. But also some brands are just recklessly going out there and saying things and doing things which they would maybe have previously got away with, but the consumer can now spot, and we're now more confident as in an industry, and also regulators are more confident at spotting it and calling it out and stopping it.
Do you feel that's on purpose? I mean, you mentioned that stat that, you know, almost half of practitioners had seen some kind of greenwashing among their organizations or their clients that they're working with. It seems very high. You'd hope that that was not on purpose.
Yeah, I mean, I don't have data to back up any sort of rational response to that. I suppose it's just a feeling of traditionally agencies would take a fee and do what the client asked them to do and wouldn't push back. Now we're gaining more confidence in that strategic advisor's role to be able to say, actually, that's not the best thing to do because that's not true. Or here's a different approach that might achieve a slightly different result, but it will still have an impact on whatever it is you're trying to achieve. I think that's the thing. We need to grow as an industry in our confidence and pushing back when we see things. And when we recognise things before it gets to a stage of, turning into an issue or a crisis. And I think that's generally got to do with the thinking around how people approach things. You know, this idea of being sustainable and, if you say that, people then immediately think, oh, I have to go and recycle. Oh, I have to go and do this. But really what we're saying is, you know, have you measured your carbon footprint? Do you know what your carbon footprint is? And do you know which areas in particular that your carbon footprint is high? You have to be able to measure things like that to know where to reduce. You then can then make informed decisions about things that you can then reduce. You can look at your supply chain and start to really, what is your supply chain doing? Because that has an impact on what you're doing. And that has an impact on your carbon footprint, and that has an impact on what you have to do at the end of the day in terms of, well, do we reduce that? Do we change that? Do we renew that? Or do we offset that? And I think that, again, kind of coming back to traditionally, people would probably jump at offsetting before they would start to think about reducing. And again, that's where we have to think about our stakeholders' needs. We have to start putting things into priority for them and for the organisation in terms of resource, and also from a timing perspective, because it's not a silver bullet. No one has an answer that there's a one-size-fits-all approach, and things will take time. But the important thing is to understand and then to take action.
My background is financial PR. So, you know, I hear a lot about this from the perspective of engagement versus divestment. So, I mean, what's your take on that? Is it going to be like Edelman was petitioned to resign all of its fossil fuel clients? Is that going to be the way forward, where agencies specifically have to, you know, can no longer represent these type of clients? Or do you have a view that engagement and trying to change from the inside is a much better way to lead?
Yeah, I mean, I think to immediately say to people you have to resign, it is not realistic. I'm the eternal optimist. I would always say try and change things before you give up. I think that's really important because I believe that everyone can change. There's no reason why people can't change. people have to want to change in the first place. They have to do the research to understand how they can change and how they can be more sustainable. And if you've tried, if it was a client and you've tried and that is not happening for whatever reason, then yes, you can, you know, leave, fire the client. I think everyone should have the opportunity to change. What I do think is could be a challenge is when it comes to the ethics of an agency and the moral compass of what good looks like and also what that change looks like as well, because there will be excuse after excuse after excuse sometimes for people to continue working with an unethical provider or client. And that's when we have to once again be brave and say no, enough's enough.
And it'll be, you know, talent will also drive that discussion, right? Because they won't want to work for those agencies who do that.
Yeah, that's the thing about coming back to this word sustainable again. You won't be sustainable if you don't have the right talent, and you won't be sustainable if you can't attract the right talent and retain the right talent. And that talent right now, if we think about it, is, you know, they are potentially sort of at university just now. There's school people just now. There are graduates just now who are moving into jobs who are they have more of a moral compass than some of the leadership team. And they're driving that conversation forward because they have been you know, brought up in a completely different time from us when, you know, we're having to learn all this, but actually they're teaching this at schools now. I don't know if you saw the other day, but there's a call for education to actually integrate climate change and sustainability within each of its learning subjects, because it should be part of, I believe, people's thinking and people's learning about how they can go about their jobs, how they can operate as human beings, and the decisions that they have to make every single day. And I think it would be wonderful if they got more of that in schools rather than just teaching it as a standalone subject. It should be integrated within all the other subjects that there's already taught.
Yeah, feels like a natural evolution, right? You've got things like Indigenous cultures are now taught much more widely in schools than they were. And, you know, financial education is now more widely taught. It feels like climate should be just another one of those topics that needs to be taught from a young age.
Yeah. I mean, you were talking about finance earlier, and there's this phrase of the triple bottom line. You know, and what you're thinking on that?
Well, I actually had a question. I was going to finish up with a question on that for you, which is, you know, and I think this might be slightly controversial, but I borrowed these terms from Tony Jakes, who's an Australian practitioner, author, and issues management specialist. And he wrote just recently, he described it, I thought this was a nice line, the conga line of initiatives and snappy acronyms. And he used the example, triple bottom line reporting, corporate social responsibility, sustainability circles, impact investment, net zero reporting, ESG. So we've got all these terms, right? And when you talk about misinformation, another academic and practitioner who I had on the podcast, Jim McNamara, who's, you know, a renowned author, in one of his books, he wrote about this idea of misinformation, not just being, you know, the Russian trolls or the Chinese hackers. It's actually professionals as well, right? PR professionals often spread these terms. And I guess my question within that is, are we as a profession guilty in many ways of spin around this issue of climate, which causes that misinformation, causes that disinformation, causes that confusion, and in many ways leads to inaction?
Long the short of it, some people, practitioners, yes. That's why I'm a member of the PRC and of the Chartered Institute of Public Relations as well, because I'm bound by a code of conduct and I believe that I should be an ethical practitioner or professional practitioner, and I shouldn't be misleading my clients, and I shouldn't be helping clients to mislead other people. It's a really serious part of our industry. And, you know, there's the argument, do we call it a profession? Do we call it an industry? I don't think we can call it a profession, because there's still people operating who aren't bound by any codes of conduct or regulated in any way, shape or form, who are going out there and doing that. And it puts our industry, you know, the famous terminology of spin doctor in the first place. I can't stand that. I don't spin anything. You know, you have to be honest. You have to put your hands up and say, yes, I did this. Yes, I did that. And this is what I'm doing to change that. But I do think that we have a challenge where the sort of spin, the people that do operate in those circles. And that was one thing that I was alluding to in my conversation, my remarks about in the States and the political scene, was that's how that started, because they wanted to influence people's their voting, essentially. And they wanted to quash climate change as a thing that was bad, because actually it was going to harm the economy more, they said. So they set out on a path to, professionally, people set out in a very strategic and very evil villain type way of going about it. And I laugh there, but it's no laughing matter. As I said before, it has had a detrimental impact on the progress to combating climate change, and also to change people's thinking of it as well. And that's the hardest part, because you know, behavior change is probably one of the most difficult things we'll ever have to do, is change people's behaviors and their thinking.
So one final question, even though I said the last one was the final one, I think we could talk about this quite a long time, but I think this research is a really good place to start for listeners out there and practitioners, just to get a grip of what others across the industry are seeing and doing. What role do you see for organizations? So obviously there's a government role here and there's an organizational role. I imagine some organizations think this is not their problem, it's a government problem. But, you know, even in Australia at the moment, we're having a debate about reducing greenhouse emissions by 43% below 2005 levels. And even that's a very soft target, and it may get watered down even further. So it feels like it really is going to be the responsibility of organizations to take the lead in this in many ways. And so how do you see that, and what's that conversation with organizations like?
Yeah, so kind of coming back to what I was saying about the work I did with Scotland's 2020 Climate Group, you know, government has to legislate. If it's not law, then businesses and organizations won't necessarily do it. But government can't do what the businesses need to do, and that is reduce the carbon footprint. Government can't do that. It's up to every individual business to look at their own business and to change, to reduce their carbon footprint, to source more ethical suppliers, to start to look at what is going to make them more sustainable in the future. And that comes back down to, yes, climate change, but at, you know, I believe it also comes back down to that wider picture of talent, inclusion, well-being, all those different factors which make up an organisation that is forward-thinking, that is future-proofing itself, and it's looking at the future as an opportunity. I think where we have big challenges around the conversations we're having around the climate crisis is that it's generally quite negatively put. You know, you've got Greta Thunberg, who's going around the world, and she's got her loudspeaker, she's got a platform, she's got the media's attention, but it's all very negatively done. And we're not really framing the solutions to organisations, and that's where they're really struggling to understand what they can do. First of all, they have to measure their carbon footprint. So that's the first thing. And you'll be surprised about how many of them don't. It's a shocking number. But we then have to break things down again for our stakeholders. So again, internal and external. But breaking things down to be relevant to our stakeholders, make them relevant, make them understandable, make them relatable, so that your stakeholders understand, so that you've then got... you understand what your stakeholders need, so then you can understand how that fits into the bigger picture of your goals. This all relates back to really thinking, doing your research, and having a strategy to go about that. And without doing that, then it's just finger in the wind, pie in the sky, and that's when you start to enter greenwashing territory.
Well, on that note, I think it's a great place to end this discussion. Laura, thank you so much for joining us and giving us a real insight into both, you know, I guess what we're seeing from the research side, but also your practical experience. It's a fascinating and I think critical area for the profession and one that I think is just going to become more important for practitioners to understand.
Yeah, I think you're right. It's one of those areas that at the moment people might listen to this and think, wow, I'd never have thought that might have been part of our roles as practitioners. But it has to be, and if we are to demonstrate that value and be the strategic function of, you know, relationships, trust, advocacy, then that has to really be part and parcel with what we do. And it really is time for us to start learning, educating ourselves, helping other people, and to make that sustainable future.
I will share those resources that you've mentioned from the PRCA as a starting point for listeners. Thank you so much, Laura.
Thank you. Thank you for the opportunity.
I am Paul Cheel, and you've been listening to Smoke Signal. Thank you for listening, and as always, remember to rate Smoke Signal on iTunes or subscribe via the blog. Just search Smoke Signal Podcast.